So tonight I'm going to talk about love. And in particular, I'm going to focus mostly on the Christian teachings of love. I really think that Christianity, in some sense, is the world's great teaching on love. And it's not to say that Buddhism doesn't talk about love. Compassion plays a large role in Buddhism. And I think people who really dive deeply into the texts of Buddhism and meditate for several hours a day, there's tremendous compassion in that tradition. Certainly some of the stories of the Tibetan monks having compassion even for the Chinese soldiers who were torturing them, this sort of thing. I think the way that Buddhism gets kind of filtered into like a, you might say, a Bay Area New Agey kind of market, the universal compassion part gets very theoretical, you know, and so there's this, you know, maybe you could say maybe a tendency to say that universal compassion is a wonderful thing, but I'm still not going to say nice things about, you know, the people in the other political party or something like that. And one of the things that I find refreshing about the Christian teachings are that they're so practical. They're so down to earth. And so I collected a number of biblical passages. These will probably seem very familiar to you if you have any experience with the Christian church. So I might as well pass these out right now. Oh, there you go. So the first one is from the Sermon on the Mount, which is a, I think Travis may need one also. Sermon on the Mount, which is chapters 5-7 of the Gospel of Matthew. And I guess traditionalists would say that Jesus went up on the hill and then he just spouted forth all this wisdom all at once. Biblical scholars suspect this is more like what you might call a greatest hits, you know, a bunch of sayings that were assembled in one place. And there are a number of famous sayings in the whole Sermon on the Mount, you know, turn the other cheek and go the extra mile, all these sayings that are very familiar. But this is just one part of it. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love only those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even Gentiles do the same? And so this whole idea that if all I'm doing is loving the people who are nice to me, there's nothing particularly spiritual about that, you know? And it really, he goes right to the heart of the challenge of, can you have genuine love for people that you consider enemies, people who offend you, people who trigger you? You know, all the people who bring you difficulties in life, can you have genuine compassion? Not a theoretical, I wish them well, but I don't want anything to do with them kind of thing, but really to love them in a way that they feel love coming from you. That's very, very hard. Another one, and this is a fascinating one. Here I did kind of a concatenation of versions from two different gospels. The same stories are often told in the first three gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, told in slightly different versions. So I sort of mixed and matched here. So from Matthew, a lawyer asked Jesus a question to test him. They were often, the Pharisees and Sadducees were often testing him, asking him these questions, hoping they could catch him in some sort of way that, you know, if he's contradicting the law of Moses or something like this, they could accuse him of blasphemy. The lawyer asked, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the Torah?" The greatest commandment in the law. And Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind. This is the greatest commandment. And the second is like it. You should love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the law and the prophets. In other words, the entire Hebrew Bible can be boiled down to these two statements of love. And then the second story that Luke adds to this, but the lawyer, desiring to justify himself, in other words, desiring to make himself a good person, says to Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Yeah, it says love your neighbor, but who is my neighbor? And then Jesus tells this very famous story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw the beaten man, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, then set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn to take care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. And then Jesus says to the lawyer, which of these three do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? The lawyer said, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. So this is the famous story of the, quote, good Samaritan. And you have to understand, in these days, the hostility between the ancient Israelites and the ancient Samaritans, it's roughly analogous to how Israelis and Palestinians might treat each other, you know? And so to translate in this slightly more modern jargon, you know, an Israeli is hurt, but it looks like a dangerous area, so other Israelis don't want to help him, but then a Palestinian risks himself and comes to the man's aid, you know? That's the nature of the story here. And what's fascinating about this, and it's really something that appears throughout Jesus' teaching in the Gospels, there's this love that just crosses boundaries of human othering. There are so many ways that we humans other each other. You know, we're them, we're us, but they're them, you know. And there's all kinds of national discourses, for example, that, you know, refugees are others, or, you know, transsexual people are other, something like that. And then that's kind of on one side of the political spectrum. And then on the other side, we're trying to other ourselves from the people who have those opinions, you know. And so there's all kinds of othering. And consistently, Jesus was talking about a kind of love or a kind of community that crossed all boundaries of human othering. This love that just extended to everyone. And admittedly, this is all completely implicit in the Buddhist ideal of universal compassion. But again, unless you dive into the detailed texts in Buddhism, the message isn't always quite as clear that universal compassion really means everyone, even those people on the other side that you don't like, you know? Another famous one, this is from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne, and before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd separates sheep from goats, and he will place the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And the king will say to those at his right hand, come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And then the righteous will answer, when did we see you hungry, thirsty, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the king will answer them, saying, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And so, and this is also something that we see throughout the New Testament, this tremendous concern for the dispossessed. And Jesus is really complete identification with the dispossessed. so that if you're kind to the person who is the most of an outcast, you're being kind to Jesus. There was a very famous parable about Saint Martin of Tours. He's a saint who lived in like the 4th or 5th century. And before he had a religious life, he was a soldier. And so one day he was riding along and he came upon a beggar who was very, very cold. And Martin felt very sorry for him. And so Martin took his cloak, cut it in half with his sword, and gave half of his cloak to this poor beggar. So he had some kind of protection from the cold. A few days later, he had a vision. Jesus appeared to him. And the story is Jesus appeared to him holding the other half of the cloak that he had given to the beggar and said, "Martin, when you gave it to the beggar, you gave it to me." And this was actually the beginning of his religious call and the beginning of his religious life. So it's a very, very deep theme in Christianity. And what I like about this also is it's not only, we can also give it a Jungian spin. And so not only all the dispossessed out there, but what are the dispossessed in here? What are the places in me that are hungry, that are thirsty, that are cold, that are starving, that are imprisoned or sick, you know? And can I have compassion for the places in myself that are dispossessed as much as I can have compassion for the dispossessed out in the world? You know, and really it's implicit in that love thy neighbor as thyself that I really do have to love myself genuinely so I can love the other genuinely. And then from the Last Supper discourse, from Jesus gives in the Gospel of John, Jesus gives a very long Last Supper discourse. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And then a little later, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lays down his life for his friends." And so that's powerful. And there are a few things there that really strike me. This whole idea that they will know you by your love. Think about, say, the large group of people who in the Bay Area who meditate. Okay? That large group. Would you say that this group is known for its love? More so than, say, people who don't meditate, you know? Art, would you say that you are known for your love? Like if someone followed any of us around with a camera for a week, would we be outstanding in our quality, in the quality of love that we are showing? You know, it's an interesting question. In some of the near-death experiences, one consistent pattern that seems to emerge for people who are out for a little while and come back is that there's this point that they have some kind of review of, you know, quick review of their whole life, and there's some kind of judge or authoritative figure there who really is not all that interested in anything else except all the instances in their life where they showed love. Like, that's the only criteria by which they're really being evaluated at that moment. You know, and so it's an interesting question. Just, if any one of us were to die tomorrow and we were going to be evaluated on how much we loved, how would we do? You know? I can't tell you that that's what happens when we die, but, you know, how would we do? And what could we do to be just a little bit better tomorrow, you know? I don't think I'm going to read this whole thing from St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. It's a very famous passage on love. They often read it at weddings and things like this, but I'll just read the beginning. "If I speak in the tongues of men and angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I have love, I am nothing. If I give away all that I have, if I deliver my body to be burned, but I have not love, I gain nothing. And just this whole idea that any other work of virtue, any other good work is meaningless if it's not driven by love, if it's not full of love. You know, and we get into all these kind of head places of, you know, well, this is good and I should be doing it. I'm going to force my way through it. And, you know, this sort of thing. We need to prove things to ourselves or others. But really, I love this emphasis from Paul of, if it doesn't have love, it doesn't matter what it is. That love is that important. And then this a famous section from the first letter of St. John. It appears that most biblical scholars would say, and this is what the traditionals would say, that whoever wrote the Gospel of John also wrote the first letter of John. They're written in very much the same style. And so they seem to have come from the same author or the same school, something like this. Beloved, let us love one another. For love is of God, and he who loves is born of God and knows God. And he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son to the world that we might live through him. Beloved, if God has so loved us, we ought to love one another. No man has seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us and his love is perfected in us. So we know and believe the love God has for us. God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and he who fears is not perfected in love. We love because he loved us first. If anyone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love the God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have him, that he who loves God should love his brother also. And so a number of powerful images there. This is the famous passage. This is, you know, where we get the idea God is love. Which in many ways, I mean, even if we step away from the Christian interpretation and step away from the God language, it's really saying that love is the most important force in the universe. Love is what's driving the universe. And in fact, this resonates very much. A few weeks ago, we talked about the principles of spiritual psychology. One of them was the principle that the universe is made of love. And another principle is that we are made of love. So just a few other quotes from St. Augustine. This one I love from St. Augustine. What does love look like? It has hands to help others. It has the feet to hasten to the poor and needy. It has eyes to see misery and want. It has ears to hear the sighs and sorrows of men. That is what love looks like. From Dostoevsky, to love someone means to see him as God intended him. You know, just a wonderful way to look at people, you know, see them in the absolute best light possible. C.S. Lewis says, do not waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor, act as if you did. You know, this whole idea that it's just an action. Thomas Merton says, to say that I am made in the image of God is to say love is the reason for my existence, for God is love. This great one from Jack Hiles, you will never really love until you love someone who hates you. That's powerful. And then finally, similar to C.S. Lewis, love is not something you feel, it is something you do.